6. "You want your paradise," the flatline advised, when Case had explained his situation. "Check Copenhagen, fringes of the university section." The voice recited coordinates as he punched. They found their paradise, a pirate's paradise, on the jumbled border of a low-security academic grid. At first glance, it resembled the kind of graffiti student operators sometimes left at the junctions of grid lines, faint glyphs of colored light that shimmered against the confused outlines of a dozen arts faculties. "There," said the flatline, "the blue one. Make it out? That's an entry code for Bell Europa. Fresh, too. Bell'll get in here soon and read the whole damn board, change any codes they find posted. Kids'll steal the new ones tomorrow." Case tapped his way into Bell Europa and switched to a standard phone code. With the flatline's help, he connected with the London database that Molly claimed was Armitage's. "Here," said the voice, "I'll do it for you." The flatline began to chant a series of digits, Case keying them on his deck, trying to catch the pauses the construct used to indicate timing. It took 3 tries. "Big deal," said the flatline. "No ice at all." "Scan this shit," Case told the Hosaka. "Sift for owner's personal history." The neuroelectronic scrawls of the paradise vanished, replaced by a simple lozenge of white light. "Contents are primarily video recordings of post-war military trials," said the distant voice of the Hosaka. "Central figure is Colonel Willis Corto." "Show it already," Case said. A man's face filled the screen. The eyes were Armitage's. 2 hours later, Case fell beside Molly on the slab and let the temper foam mold itself against him. "You find anything?" she asked, her voice fuzzy with sleep and drugs. "Tell you later," he said. "I'm wrecked." He was hungover and confused. He lay there, eyes closed, and tried to sort the various parts of a story about a man called Corto. The Hosaka had sorted a thin store of data and assembled a précis, but it was full of gaps. Some of the material had been print records, reeling smoothly down the screen, too quickly, and Case had had to ask the computer to read them for him. Other segments were audio recordings of the Screaming Fist hearing. Willis Corto, Colonel, had plummeted through a blind spot in the Russian defenses over Kerensk. The shuttles had created the hole with pulse bombs, and Corto's team had dropped in night-wing microlights, their wings snapping taut in moonlight, reflected in jags of silver along the rivers Ungara and Patkamania, the last light Corto would see for 15 months. Case tried to imagine the microlights blossoming out of their launch capsules, high above a frozen steppe. "They sure as hell did shaft you, boss," Case said, and Molly stirred beside him. The microlights had been unarmed, stripped to compensate for the weight of a console operator, a prototype deck, and a virus program called Mole-9, the first true virus in the history of cybernetics. Corto and his team had been training for the run for 3 years. They were through the ice, ready to inject Mole-9, when the imps went off. The Russian pulse guns threw the jockeys into electronic darkness. The night wings suffered systems crash, flight circuitry wiped clean. Then the lasers opened up, aiming on infrared, taking out the fragile radar-transparent assault planes, and Corto and his dead console man fell out of a Siberian sky. Fell and kept falling. There were gaps in the story here, where Case scanned documents concerning the flight of a commandeered Russian gunship that managed to reach Finland, to be gutted as it landed in a spruce grove by an antique 20-millimeter cannon manned by a cadre of reservists on dawn alert. Screaming Fist had ended for Corto on the outskirts of Helsinki, with Finnish paramedics sawing him out of the twisted belly of the helicopter. The war ended 9 days later, and Corto was shipped to a military facility in Utah, blind, legless, and missing most of his jaw. It took 11 months for the congressional aide to find him there. He listened to the sound of tubes draining. In Washington and McLean, the show trials were already underway. The Pentagon and the CIA were being balkanized, partially dismantled, and a congressional investigation had focused on Screaming Fist. Ripe for watergating, the aide told Corto. He'd need eyes, legs, and extensive cosmetic work, the aide said, but that could be arranged. New plumbing, the man added, squeezing Corto's shoulder through the sweat-damp sheet. Corto heard the soft, relentless dripping. He said he preferred to testify as he was. No, the aide explained, the trials were being televised. The trials needed to reach the voter. The aide coughed politely. Repaired, refurnished, and extensively rehearsed, Corto's subsequent testimony was detailed, moving, lucid, and largely the invention of a congressional cabal with certain vested interests in saving particular portions of the Pentagon infrastructure. Corto gradually understood that the testimony he gave was instrumental in saving the careers of three officers directly responsible for the suppression of reports on the building of the EMP installations at Kerensk. His role in the trials over, he was unwanted in Washington. In an M Street restaurant, over asparagus crepes, the aide explained the terminal dangers involved in talking to the wrong people. Corto crushed the man's larynx with the rigid fingers of his right hand. The congressional aide strangled, his face in an asparagus crepe, and Corto stepped out into cool Washington September. The Hosaka rattled through police reports, corporate espionage records, and news files. Case watched Corto work corporate defectors in Lisbon and Marrakesh, where he seemed to grow obsessed with the idea of betrayal, to loathe the scientists and technicians he bought out for his employers. Drunk in Singapore, he beat a Russian engineer to death in a hotel and set fire to his room. Next, he surfaced in Thailand as overseer of a heroin factory. Then as enforcer for a California gambling cartel, then as a paid killer in the ruins of Bonn. He robbed a bank in Wichita. The record grew vague, shadowy, the gaps longer. One day, he said in a taped segment that suggested chemical interrogation, everything had gone gray. Translated French medical records explained that a man without identification had been taken to a Paris mental health unit and diagnosed as schizophrenic. He became catatonic and was sent to a government institution on the outskirts of Toulon. He became a subject in an experimental program that sought to reverse schizophrenia through the application of cybernetic models. A random selection of patients were provided with microcomputers and encouraged, with help from students, to program them. He was cured, the only success in the entire experiment. The record ended there. Case turned on the phone, and Molly cursed him softly for disturbing her. The telephone rang. He pulled it into bed. Yeah? We're going to Istanbul, Armitage said. Tonight. What does the bastard want? Molly asked. Says we're going to Istanbul tonight. That's just wonderful. Armitage was reading off flight numbers and departure times. Molly sat up and turned on the light. What about my gear? Case asked. My deck. Finn will handle it, said Armitage, and hung up. Case watched her pack. There were dark circles under her eyes, but even with the cast on, it was like watching a dance. No wasted motion. His clothes were a rumpled pile beside his bag. You hurting? He asked. I could do with another night at Chin's. You're a dentist? You betcha. Very discreet. He's got half that rack, full clinic, does repairs for samurai. She was zipping her bag. You ever been to Stamboul? Couple days once. Never changes, she said. Bad old town. It was like this when we headed for Chiba, Molly said, staring out the train window at blasted industrial moonscape, red beacons on the horizon warning aircraft away from a fusion plant. We were in L.A. He came in and said, pack. We were booked for Macau. When we got there, I played Fantan in the Lijvoa, and he crossed over into Zhongshan. Next day, I was playing Ghost with you in Night City. She took a silk scarf from the sleeve of her black jacket and polished the insets. The landscape of the northern sprawl woke confused memories of childhood for Case. Dead grass tufting the cracks in a canted slab of freeway concrete. The train began to decelerate 10 kilometers from the airport. Case watched the sunrise on the landscape of childhood, on broken slag and the rusting shells of refineries.